From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Rolott, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Joshua Landis and I will discuss what Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's speech in Washington this week says about a possible shift in U.S.-Middle East alliances. Many traditional U.S. allies are worried Washington might shift toward Iran and away from Israel and Saudi Arabia.
We both support the attempt to destroy ISIS. So, in a sense, we're fighting in the same trench.
Later, Joshua and Rebecca Cruz talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Gordon Wood. He compares this decade's uprisings in the Arab world to what he calls an Atlantic Spring that started in 1776.
And if you conclude the revolutions of 1848, that's 75 years of revolutions, all of which, except for one, failed.
200 years of advice for the Middle East, right after this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Rolott. Joshua Landis, the big news coming out of Washington, as we've been talking about for some time now, is Benjamin Netanyahu's visit to Congress. He addressed a joint session of Congress. And it's not so much, you know, the politics of it. Let's leave that aside. But let's talk about some of the implications in a more international political context, because it raises some issues of this shift in U.S.-Middle East alliances. Some are suggesting that Washington is really looking to realign toward Iran, maybe away from Saudi Arabia and Israel and other friends in the Middle East, and that this is causing a lot of anxiety. So give us the lay of the land here in terms of, you know, how all of this is going to shake out, leaving aside, again, just kind of the domestic and, you know, politics and the U.S.-Israeli relationship. There's a real shift going on in the Middle East, perhaps, in alliances and the balance of power.
Well, it's true. The expansion of ISIS has really challenged us. Who is our big enemy in the Middle East, Iran or ISIS? That seems to be at the heart of this debate. And Prime Minister Netanyahu's coming to the United States was really a plea. Do not ally with Iran against ISIS. We need to prioritize the fight against Iran. And that's what Netanyahu wants. He wants America not to make this deal with Iran, but rather to challenge Iran, potentially militarily. And that's what frightens President Obama. He doesn't want to go to war with Iran. He wants to freeze the nuclear development. But it underlines a larger shift, because just yesterday, Prince Saud, the Saudi foreign minister, said the offensive to retake Tikrit, an Iraqi city where Saddam Hussein was born, shows how Iran is taking over that country.
Iran is actually now getting involved in taking back some of this territory.
Absolutely. And, you know, we, the United States, has been trying to prepare the Iraqi army to retake Mosul, this big city in the north of Iraq, Sunni, traditionally majority Sunni city, but it had 60,000 Christians who were chased out, all of the Yazidis and so forth. And we just said we weren't ready for a spring offensive that we had first announced, but maybe it'll have to go in the summer or the fall. But lo and behold, Iran is teamed up with the Iraqi army and they're retaking Tikrit. And there's a major offensive being 27,000 troops are massed to retake Tikrit. And this has the Saudis in a complete
And the U.S. is supporting this. The U.S. is behind it. The U.S. is supporting.
Well, you know, the U.S. doesn't know how to go on this. The U.S. is a little bit anxious, because it underlines to what extent we're, in fact, de facto allies, even though we're not.
Because we have the same interests. We have the same interests going on here, right?
Destroy ISIS. And we both support the government in Baghdad. And we both support the attempt to destroy ISIS. So in a sense, we're fighting in the same trench. And this has the Saudis very concerned. It has the Israelis concerned.
And the Turkish.
And the Turks as well. So our traditional allies, the Sunni powers of the Middle East and Israel, are all perplexed. They're scratching their heads. And President Obama, I must say, has said that he wants to balance Iran and Saudi Arabia. In the past, we've been firmly in Saudi camp against Iran. But today we need Iran. And that means, you know, the speechwriter who wrote President Bush's famous line about the axis of evil, placing Iran at the center of evil.
Iran, Iraq, and North Korea as the axis of evil.
Yes. Just yesterday tweeted the emerging U.S.-Iran-Syria-Hezbollah alliance is about the weirdest foreign policy event I can recall. So he's now the executive editor of Atlantic Magazine. Lots of people are scratching their heads and wondering what is going on. And there are shifts going on. America has realigned because of ISIS. Alliances are shifting.
So Israel obviously isn't taking this kindly, either of the Saudis. They aren't natural allies either, are they? I mean, it's interesting. There's a lot of strange bedfellows going on here in general.
There are. There's been an incipient alliance between Saudi Arabia and Israel over Egypt, over a number of events, over Iran. And that alliance is now increasingly becoming outspoken because Saudis have been publishing. They've supported Netanyahu's visit to the American Congress to try to undermine the president's growing treaty with – or potential treaty with Iran.
All right, Joshua. Always fascinating. Thank you for being here and shedding some light.
Always a pleasure.
If you have any thoughts about this conversation, let us know by leaving your questions and comments in the Worldview section of our website. We also welcome your feedback on Twitter, at WorldviewsKGOU, at Suzette Gralat, and at Joshua_Landis. You can also subscribe to our podcast and download this show from iTunes, and read transcripts and in-depth recaps of all of our interviews at KGOU.org. Next, Joshua and Rebecca Cruz speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Gordon Wood about parallels between the American Revolution and the Arab Spring. I'm Suzette Gralat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gralat. Our guest today is Gordon Wood. He's a professor of history emeritus at Brown University, where he taught for 4 decades. He spent his entire career studying the earliest days of the United States, and his 1992 book, The Radicalism of the American Revolution, won the Pulitzer Prize for History a year later. The book was widely praised by Newt Gingrich in the early 1990s before he became House Speaker. He argues there are a lot of similarities between the U.S. struggle for independence in the 1770s and 80s and what's gone on this decade in the Middle East.
Well, today we're joined by Gordon Wood, who's one of the premier scholars of the American Revolution. We're very thrilled to have you. Welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, as I said, you have done a great deal, several decades, in fact, of research on the American Revolution. You know, I would guess, almost everything about it. So today we're going to talk a little bit about what the lessons we can learn from that revolution and how we can think about them in our modern context and looking around the world at additional revolutions and what maybe we can take from our American Revolution. So just starting perhaps from the beginning, our founders and later the framers were part of an age of enlightenment. And so I'm curious as to how that era of kind of challenging the traditional roles, thinking about science in a new way, how that influenced our revolutionaries and what role that played. And then if you think that this is necessary for a revolutionary era to have kind of this new enlightenment.
Well, yes, I think you do need a sense that changes are in the air and things are going to be different. And that certainly was true at the end of the 18th century. But I think it's important to realize that there, you know, before there was we've talked about an Arab Spring that swept through the Middle East. But before that, there was an Atlantic Spring that began actually in 1776 and went on for at least 50 years. And if you conclude the revolutions of 1848, which were part of that revolutionary turmoil, that's 75 years of revolutions, all of which, except for one, failed. So that when Abraham Lincoln comes to the presidency and he says, "We are the last best hope," the revolutions of 1848 were all attempts to become republics, overthrowing monarchies and becoming republics, and they all failed. They lasted, you know, 2 years. And so when he says we're the last best hope for democracy, that was true. So, but our revolution started the whole ball rolling. 1776, followed by the French Revolution, was something the French had never forgiven us for. And they, many people thought it was a copy of ours, that when Lafayette sends George Washington the key to the Bastille, which was the symbol of the Ancien Régime, the prison that was destroyed and at the outset of their revolution. He sends it to Washington as a tribute to recognition that the Americans had inspired us, and that key hangs in Mount Vernon today. So a sense of revolution was in the air, and it continued for, well, 75 years, and all of them failing.
Why did the United States Revolution, why was it successful?
Well, I think to put it bluntly, we had experience with self-government. We forget that the colonists had been more or less running their own colonies. The empire was loosely run by the British through 150 years. And so we had experience with self-government. We'd been electing our legislatures, colonial legislatures. We had English rights, habeas corpus, trial by jury. We had all these things behind us, and the French did not. They had not had a meeting of their legislature, the States General, for, well, since 1614 or something like that. So whereas we had continual representation, not democracy by modern standards, but certainly the most democratic colonies or states in the world at the time. Two-thirds of white adult males could vote. I mean, there was nothing like that, even in England. So we had this tremendous experience of going back decades, a century in some cases, a century or more. So we were prepared in a way that the other places were not.
Now, one of the main thrusts of your work on the American Revolution has been that this was a revolution of the mind. There really was a radical departure and then a consolidation of the Enlightenment thought. When you look at Egypt, the Arab Spring, the winning parties are all religious parties. In a sense, they're reacting against an imposed nationalist regimes that are really the post-colonial regimes. And there's this tussle going on in the Middle East between a radical religious agenda and a more pro-Western agenda. How do you see that? Do you need Enlightenment thought? How does that fit in?
We have to realize that the previous century, the 17th century and the 16th century before that, we had religious wars in the West that are fully as violent and as disruptive as the fights that are going on within Islam between Sunnis and Shia. Catholics and Protestants were killing each other by the tens of thousands. And if they'd had modern technology, modern bombs and so on, the death rate would have been even higher. So in that sense, that's what the Middle East is going through, real religious wars. Ours went on for centuries. The 30 Years' War, which was a 17th century war, was really brutal and bloody. And it took that. The experience of that, out of that comes the sense of religious toleration and the sense that we can't keep killing each other because of religious beliefs. But that took a long time.
So you would really see the analogy between what the Middle East is going through today and what the West went through as this lead up to the American Revolution, the age of reason, the wars of religion, and in a sense leading up to the Peace of Westphalia in 1648,
right,
where you have finally the Catholics say we can't kill all the Protestants and they have to come to some kind of
accommodation. Agreement. That's right. And it took a while. It took a lot of bloodshed. And I think things will get telescoped now, but I think it's very difficult for Muslims to conceive of religious liberty in our sense, certainly in the sense of neutralizing religion as we did in the revolution, where we said the state should have no role. At least Virginia said this, and Jefferson's bill for religious freedom was quite extraordinary for the time. And it came because of the multiplicity of sects, of religious denominations, and only because of that, although Jefferson tended to believe that it was because people became more reasonable and more humanist, James Madison knew better, and Madison saw that the success of that bill depended on the fact that the Presbyterians, the Baptists, the Methodists were so jealous and so frightened of the Episcopalians getting control of the state that they were willing to neutralize the state in religious matters. If the Presbyterians could have been assured that they would be the dominant denomination in control of the state apparatus, they would not have agreed to religious freedom. But because no one could be sure, they were willing to neutralize the state. Now, the Muslims are eons away from that kind of conception. In fact, I was at a conference where Muslim scholars discussing Jefferson's bill couldn't comprehend the idea of separation of church and state. They said, if religion is important, then the state must be involved in it. Well, we made a break from that, and that was one of the major breaks. And really, we were way ahead of any place in the world at the time in conceiving of the state being neutralized in religious matters without religion being hurt. We had religion thrived in the aftermath of religious freedom that occurred in the revolutionary time. We were more religious and remain more religious than most states in the Western world, maybe possible exception of Poland and in Ireland. But religion thrives in the United States in a way that it doesn't in England or France or Italy.
Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Gordon Wood speaking to our contributors Joshua Landis and Rebecca Cruz. We'll hear more of their conversation right after this short break. I'm Suzette Gralat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gralat, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. This half hour, we're talking with Gordon Wood, a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian who studies the American Revolution. He's drawn comparisons between the U.S. War for Independence in the 18th century and the Arab Spring uprisings that started in 2010. He spoke with our contributors, Joshua Landis and Rebecca Cruz.
Well, if we think about some of these issues that you've discussed in the lead up to our Revolutionary War, there's kind of an old saying that it's the revolution's the easy part. It's the transition to democracy or away from authoritarianism that's the difficult part. And we certainly have seen that in Egypt and other places throughout the Middle East and elsewhere. And we often think in our own history that this was a relatively smooth period. We fought a revolution, we put together a constitution, and everything has been fantastic. This obviously isn't the case.
No.
But can you share with us what that transition period was
forget,
like?
We forget that the distance between the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution is a decade, and it was a very tumultuous decade, not just because of the war, but because the constitutions that were created in 1776 were state constitutions. And we did not think no one even conceived of a strong federal government, which was created 10 years later. It didn't even enter their imaginations. So something awful had to happen in that period to get people to think in terms of creating this strong national government. And that thing that happened was an excess of democracy. Democracy was running wild in the states. James Madison wrote a paper called Vices of the Political System of the United States, most important document between the Declaration and the actual Constitution, although it was never published. It was his working paper. He would outline what's wrong with our system and what can we do about it. And what he said was the state legislatures were running amok. Majorities were pressing minorities. There was a multiplicity of legislation, a mutability of legislation, meaning the changeability of legislation, and the injustice of this legislation. And so the Constitution becomes his solution. He does not want to go towards an authoritarian solution, which is, of course, what the Egyptians finally arrived at. In last year, in the spring of 2013, President Morsi, the Muslim Brotherhood president, was still in control, but the society was going chaotic. It was a crime in the streets. And we know what happened. In July, General Sisi moves in and there's a military coup. And now he's been elected president and we're back to a Mubarak kind of authoritarian rule. Well, that was a choice that Americans talked about. Should General Washington become a dictator? Some people wanted him to become king. And Madison said, we're not going to go down that route. We're going to find a Republican remedy for Republican ills. And the Constitution becomes that. He wants to stay within what we would call the democratic framework. Democracy is the problem, but we're going to try to find a solution to it and still retain a belief in majority rule and democratic policies. And that's the federal Constitution.
Can I switch a little bit away from the Middle East and look at the education in the United States, something that you've clearly been involved with for a long time. The success of the revolution, American Revolution, was partly because we had small class differences, not as profound as Europe.
Right.
And And we have had a very educated republic. The public school system, of course, which developed later, laid the foundations for a solid democracy. Today, many Americans feel that that's jeopardized. We've had the Piketty book come out telling us about the growing inequality. Right. And is that America just catching up and being competitive in a modern world? Or is that a republic going to seed?
Well, I think historically we are at about the same spot we were in about 1890, 1900. In terms of foreign born, we're about the same. About 14% of the population is foreign born. That was true in 1900 and it's true today. The gap between wealth is very great. Inequality is very high, but that was true in 1900. We took certain steps in the progressive era. One of them was, of course, immigration restriction. Which was the effort to deal with the foreign-born percentage of the population. We also had intensive efforts at Americanization. People were much more frightened. We think we're, oh, my goodness, all these foreigners coming in. It was much greater in 1900. And of course, the response was to limit European. We were worried about Southern Europeans, Italians, Jews, Eastern Europeans coming to the United States. And so we made restrictions that came out in the 1920s in immigration restriction. We haven't panicked in that way now, and we're much more relaxed. Even despite you hear all the rhetoric, it certainly is a much better situation now. But the inequality is very high, and that has to do, I think, a good deal with the technology is outrunning the capacity of the educational system to keep up. We don't have – there are lots of jobs available, but they require skills that we just don't have. And I think that's going to take some while to correct that. But my guess – and I'm not an expert in this area – but my guess is that part of the inequality of wealth is coming from – and the problem of the so-called middle class is coming from the fact that their skills are not – adequate to meet the needs. And there are jobs going begging, but they're in highly skilled computer-type fields that they're simply – educational system hasn't kept up with it. We can hope that that will be remedied over the coming decades. But that's one source of, I think, of our inequality.
Well, unfortunately, we're about out of time, but we want to thank you so much for joining us today. Gordon Wood, thank you for being on Worldviews.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Rebecca Cruz and Joshua Landis talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Gordon Wood. You can watch a video of his lecture at the University of Oklahoma's inaugural teach-in event in 2012 on our website, kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews alongside OU's College of International Studies. Sam Dupre works as our digital content intern and prepared the post on our website. Brian Hardzinski produces the show, and our research fellow is Symphony Swift. For Joshua Landis and Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Grelott.